Welcome, Red Eyes members. We are talking with Edmund Marriage about the Anunnaki, the Karsag location. That's the possible place for the Garden of Eden. We're going to talk more about this later on here in this second part. But I'd like to begin to talk about something that we briefly got into here in the first hour, at the end of the first hour, regarding some of the research of Peter Kedrowan Taylor and about his discoveries or research, at least around surrounding the magnetic fields of the sun and the earth, and the possible, you know, that this could have something to do with the alignment of 2012 as well, the galactic alignment, and that this might actually affect our climate in another way. Many people now, of course, are talking about global warming. We're also kind of dissecting the mythology around the global warming at the same time, and more and more as more and more research comes to light, we discovered that this is a fraud, basically, to run global politics through. They're setting it up as a big global threat, and everyone is to join hands, and they can steer us in either way they want here, unfortunately, with this threat of global warming. But Edmund, tell us a little bit about Peter and what he's been researching. He's primarily then looking into global cooling as the next thing. Is that it, or where is he coming from?
Yes, Peter gave us an excellent lecture, which is on the Golden Age Project website. And so you can look at his first lecture and draw your own conclusions on his knowledge and skill. But he was he spent his life as a scientist, and I believe he can be termed as a leading environmental scientist. He first became involved with the pollution of the oceans and also the issues about nuclear waste, and did very valuable work on that. I found that he was – I went to one of his talks on global – the issue of global warming, and I found that his views agreed with mine. I've been solid for about 6 years since I went to an environmental conference in England at Taunton and made the point that, which I haven't had to change, is that the sun is so powerful and such a big influence that it was crazy to think that man really is making much difference, or that CO2 is a major greenhouse gas which is influenced also by man. And in addition to that, my point then, 6 years ago, was that even if we could do something about our climate, we couldn't afford to do it. And therefore, the whole thesis of spending vast sums of taxpayers' money, remember, on trying to do something about fossil fuels and global warming and CO2, as much as we need to be much more efficient with our energy, and to allow for the fact that oil won't last forever, we do need to take actions, but we don't need to scare everybody to death, tax everybody to the hilt, invent carbon markets, which don't exactly do the job they're supposed to do, and may well fail completely, on the basis that CO2 is something very bad that we are responsible for. Most interestingly, I find that people growing crops in greenhouses, even in Japan, I think, where large steel manufacturers have had to close down and have changed their workshops over to growing lettuces. No. One of the things that we find is that if our plants are going to grow fast to feed us, then we have to pump in CO2 into those greenhouse environments, because yeah, that's what plants love. The kind of fires we've seen in Australia this last year, the kind of peat bog fires in Indonesia have contributed massive quantities of CO2 to the atmosphere, dwarfing the output of man. And we need to be sensible and also listen to both points of view. Our BBC reported on the Copenhagen meeting. All they seemed to say was that sea levels are going to rise dramatically, which was extrapolating short-term trends based on a single sea level instrument in Hong Kong Harbour, I'm told, which was not reliable. yet the really important conference in New York, which dealt with the alternative view, simply wasn't even reported.
Yeah.
And that seems to me to be just unforgivable that people can be so politically driven and inspired. And I know from my own lobbying of government in this country that if you don't say what they want you to say, then you're sidelined. There isn't a debate.
That's right. And they do it by the aid of exclusion of certain information in order to steer, well, the agenda, the geopolitical global agenda that is running on, and this global warming threat has served them very well, and I think it will continue to do so as long as people are not smart enough to analyze it and criticize it. Yet at the same time, they're talking about the unity that every scientist agree, yada yada yada, in the media, but that's not true either. You know, there's so many people who are intelligence have managed to dissect the whole, the whole threat that they're talking about, and that it's simply not there. It doesn't jive at all. And what you talk about as well with CO2 levels, that frightened me on another level, because if we specifically look at plant life, if we look at how we are provided oxygen that is through the aid of CO2, and if we start cutting back on that, and even I don't know what they're going to do next. Of course, they cannot possibly even begin to, what you call it, compete with a volcanic eruption, the amount of CO2 that is released from that. So nothing compared to it if we compare it to what we put out when we drive our cars, or the industry that we have. It's nothing compared to that. But do you think that there could be some kind of could this actually be affecting our plants in some way, are obviously the planet, but the way we grow food and so forth, that the climate or that even the plants have big, how should I call it? It has begun to take advantage of the situation that it's in. But now, when we're cutting back on that, could that have some kind of effect, or this whole deal with the anthropogenic, meaning human created global warming? Do you think that's all bunk and we have nothing to do on it?
I think there are minor effects, and that's what people hang their hats on. Mm. And what we're putting together is a whole load of researchers who have all climbed into individual boxes and are not looking across the top of the boxes and dealing with it in a multidisciplinary way. And that's why Peter Cadron-Taylor's lecture on my website is so good, because it explains so many different factors affect climate. And also that the first and most important lie was to suggest that CO2 in fact led temperature, when it was quite clear that temperature moved first and CO2 followed.
Yes.
I've got a wonderful chart which shows that when we're looking about the earliest agriculture all around the world, following this global catastrophe and so-called ice age, CO2 levels were very, very low. And it was only when those CO2 levels began to rise sufficiently that we began to get the big expansion of agricultural produce. That's a lesson from history. We also know, too, that we were something like 2 degrees centigrade warmer at the time of Stonehenge in England. And also, we've doubled the rainfall on the Marlborough Downs and Marlborough Plain, on which many of those ancient structures like Avebury and the early farmers had occupied. And so to say that we have never been hotter is another big lie. There have been two very warm periods, which we call the Holocene climatic optimum, the second of which was peaked at around 4,200 BC. And this is where we see a massive expansion of people and colonization around the world, simply because everything had been so successful in terms of food production and population increase. And the city-states were rather like eggs dividing. The young king would be qualified for the job, would take a group of people, craftsmen, say 200 craftsmen and their families, and go off and start another city-state somewhere else. And much of that involved going abroad to colonize unknown territory. And so we see this massive expansion of the Indo-European peoples all around the globe around about from this period of 4,200 BC, which was a climatic optimum, much warmer than it is now, has been in the last 50 years.
And the was much better to grow food at that point as well. People have even talked the higher amounts of oxygen in the atmosphere created a better environment and even a healthier human being. Do you think that that could have been the case as well?
My clear view is that although the hunter-gatherer lived on his wits and must have been much sharper and brighter than us because he had to bring that food in every day to his family, we probably got a little lazier when we had agriculture. But on the other hand, the agriculture was such an incredible gift, which really enabled people to settle and become sedentary, as they say, and to be able to develop the arts and crafts and civilization as we know it. And I believe that Anunnaki, our ancestors, were obsessed with diet, a wide and varied diet. And see this in the records. And they understood at least how important diet was. I believe there was a great deal of sophistication within those city-state societies. And that's why they were so successful for so long, with such vigorous people and such incredible crafts and trade, and peace, and peaceful times.
Do you think they lived longer, or any other differences compared to what we have today?
Well, there are varying amounts of research, and we've gone through good times and bad times. And in the bad times, clearly people were not eating the right food, but was relying on one crop. For example, like potatoes in the 1750s and the 1850s, there were two big potato famines. People always remember the second one. Mm. But I think that the way in which different societies thrived and prospered, we actually see an awful lot of problems from this time of 2350 BC, because we have major catastrophes which must have caused all sorts of problems for people. 2100, 2800 BC, 1650 BC. We actually have had a lot of what I call cyclical or episodic cometary problems between 2350 and about 500 AD. We've been very lucky since 500 AD, when the Romans left Britain and things got so bad they stopped minting currency, and the occupants of the town of Cirencester, which now is about 17,000 people and was up to 10,000 people in Roman times, just in a very short space of time, the people had died, and the survivors had simply fortified the amphitheatre. So a few hundred people were just the survivors of a town of 10,000 people. Mm. That was about this figure of 500 AD. And so we've had problems like Tunguska, which is said to be a centennial risk by people like Professor Victor Kluge. We actually had a Tunguska-type object within 50,000 miles of the planet about 6 weeks ago, which we wouldn't have been able to do anything about. If it had come down over any populated area, it would have been the biggest catastrophe of all time. Mm. If Tunguska had happened over Belgium, it would have killed everybody in Belgium. And so the astrophysicists have long been saying that we've had good times, but we're now going through an arm of the galaxy where there is a much higher risk of this kind of cometary debris, which is just simply repeating problems we had in the past. So good times, we eat well, we live long. Bad times, we die very suddenly and quickly. Crops fail, and we have an awful lot of people starving to death. Now, that was before we had this population explosion. So if we have history repeats itself with populations of 6, 7, 8, or 9 billion people, then we've got real, really serious problems to contend with.
Hmm. And when you're saying time, are you referring to astrological time, meaning that it's in larger cycles, so to speak, that we might be entering into such a period now because of our location in the galaxy, but that might extend over a couple of hundred years, or are we talking about a shorter period here? What do you think?
I think it's got to be looking at maybe over a 500-year period. Although it is very important to remember what our Astronomer Royal has actually said. And he says that we only have a 50% chance of getting through the next 100 years without a major catastrophe.
Really?
So, you know, we've got to be realistic. If you live in Switzerland, you've got a very good atom bomb shelter in your basement. And so there are all sorts of things that people should be doing, like having enough fresh water to last for a month or two or more, stored food. There's a whole number of practical things that people should be encouraged to do, far more important than the kind of climate change things that people are being demanded of people. And so we need to get our priorities straight on the basis of historical knowledge and sensible practical knowledge.
And speaking of cataclysm, then, let's talk about the activity of the sun, the magnetic field, and the relationship between the sun and the earth. Do you think that that could lead to something bad as well as we're entering into this new active cycle of the sun, and could our planet be affected by that in some way?
Well, Peter will be talking about this in Suffolk, and I haven't heard him speak and haven't heard the latest information from him. But what I do know is that we are now going. We've had on the bottom of sunspot cycle 23. We've had hardly any sunspots at all.
No.
We now head upwards in sunspot cycle 24, and then we eventually head for sunspot cycle 25. And the suggestion is that the trend of solar activity is going down. And certainly the heliosphere is weakening, which one would expect if the sun is less active. And when the heliosphere weakens, then we have more cosmic rays coming in to our atmosphere. And it's these cosmic rays which create low-level clouds actually give us this situation whereby if enough cosmic waves come through our atmosphere when the sun is very weak, we actually end up with what's called snowball Earth. That's how it happened. And very good research from a Danish space team on this particular subject.
Yes, I think he wrote a book called The Cooling Stars or something like that.
That's right.
Yeah.
The Chilling Stars.
The Chilling Stars, that's right, exactly.
Yeah. Another important read to look at this extraordinarily complex process of what drives climate. And, of course, the people who have been able to look at sunspot cycles closely have had very good track records on forecasting weather. And also people who have studied the El Nino, too, have got very good track records of forecasting weather. And the general in my opinion, scientific view is that we are far more likely to go into a colder period than a warmer period, that we've had a major peak over the last 10 years. Temperatures have not gone up for something like 8 years. They've tended to go down. We've had record cold winters in places like Asia and America over the past 2 years. Peter's book was originally titled Global Cooling. It's going to be out in the spring. The publishers have decided to change the name, which is a bit of a shame, but publishers always do that, make it harder. But I do think that Peter's talk is going to be well worthwhile listening to. And we've got a lot of excellent people on this climate change subject. If you look at the websites on climate change, what's up with that? A gentleman called Watts is one of the favorites. But there's a terrific amount of valuable information for any student to be able to get a balanced view, and he can make his own mind, or she can make their own minds up as to who's telling the truth, who's scientifically based, and get a clearer idea of what is actually happening.
Absolutely. And wouldn't that be kind of an irony, though, if we end up in some kind of almost a mini ice age circumstance here in the next couple of years, or the following, I don't know, 10, 20, 30 years or something like that. I don't know if it's going to extend so far that we're actually going to get another ice age, but I've heard people talk about it and even begin to warn about it, that this is an effect, you know, of what we're seeing now with the increased sun activity, as you just explained, with the cosmic rays, with the clouds and all this stuff. And I mean, in that situation, there would be planetary upheaval. There would be probably wars going on over resources. We could, you know, basically, we can't do anything to stop an event like that. When the Earth is in a situation like that, we just have to follow through, and there would be, you know, mass migrations to further south and further north from the south in order to try to survive, basically. And that wouldn't be a pretty picture, I think.
Well, I'm sure you're right. And those scientists who've studied ice cores and studied temperature records and looked at past history, what has staggered them has been the rapidity of the change from warm to cold. Within a period of 10 years, you've gone from what we think is normal now to horrific cold times. And it's these, the speed at which in the past things have changed is really the most shocking statistic that we have within the records.
With examples of mammoths having fresh food in their mouths, you know, flowers have been frozen instantly. There's a number of these finds that have been done, meaning that whatever, you know, however the cold air got into this particular region, it hit in just a few hours, basically, and everything just froze in its place. And that's that could potentially again mean that we are looking at some kind of day after tomorrow type scenario here. I don't know if you've seen that movie, but that's based on a book called Global Superstorm or something similar, I think, which talks a little bit about this type of science that is potentially behind this. So we could be seeing or witnessing something like that in the next couple of years if we're unlucky, of course. But do you think that the sun's increased energy, though, could take us in the other direction or in the other way, that we actually are getting a warmer climate because more energy is being put out by the sun? That would be the logical conclusion in one sense, I guess, but I don't know if you have any ideas about that.
Yes, well, the mammoth story is very interesting because Derek Allen, who was the co-author of Cataclysm with Bernard Dallaire, has done a very good paper, which is actually on, it was about to go on my website, where what he's claiming is that supercooled nitrogen from space, so it would be supercooled if it came from space, but clouds of nitrogen simply hit the Siberian tundra and froze the mammoths where they were, and the ground beneath the mammoths up to 300 or 400 feet deep.
Really?
Jeez. Absolutely staggering. And then we have the story of massive quantities of water, which of course would freeze in space, raining down as ice on the planet as well. And so the kind of problems that we've had in the past are now being better understood. And a massive supernova explosion and the debris from that supernova explosion would consist of a whole range of elements that could do extraordinary things, which we haven't really contemplated. And, of course, at the time of the catastrophe at 10,700, 800, then we actually see the Earth moving on its axis, being tipped on its axis. And even Enoch talks about this, and the inclination was referred to in a translation of the books of Enoch in 1827. But back to today, we've got to look with the sunspot specialist at what is happening to our heliosphere, whether or not the alignment of the Earth's magnetic field with the sun's magnetic field will open up a hole or open up conditions under which we will lose our magnetic shield from cosmic radiation and solar flares. Whether or not our satellite system can stand up to that, I don't know. This is why it's probably better to have broadband rather than satellite connection.
There you go.
good bit of advice there.
And then so, we'll be all right. Yeah, exactly. As long as we got the broadband, it'll be fine.
As long as we got the broadband. So we don't want to scare people.
No.
What we're concerned about is that we're being scared on very flimsy scientific information.
Yes.
And there was a book once written by Gustave Le Bon, which was The Popular Delusions and Madness of Crowds. Well, that's where we are today, the popular delusions and madness of crowds, certainly with our financial system, certainly with climate change, certainly with many things about our planet. We need good, sound, common sense and the master craftsman, the old traditional master craftsman, to be allowed to give best advice on the subjects they know best and not to listen to politicians and journalists on issues which they know nothing about. That's our problem.
When you mentioned before there about the axis as well, that the cataclysm this is what happened, that the earth was damaged, if you will, in that sense. But would that mean that we didn't have the seasons as we think of them before this period then?
Well, there have been minor incidents where there was no summer. The winter lasted all summer. We've had those kind of instances. And if you get a terrific volcanic eruption and vast quantities of dust going into the air, and I think it was Tomboba or something like that, one of the volcanoes in about 1816, I think it was, when Byron was around, when there was just no summer. It was just winter lasted all summer. And that kind of thing has been a feature of past history. Mm. And so we've only got to look at what happens if you get two or three very cold winters. And we saw thousands of animals frozen to death the winter before last in Asia, for example, which really checked people. And America has suffered another cold winter this winter. And so we've always been exposed to these kind of weather problems. And they are cyclical. They go up and down. And they are clearly driven by the electromagnetic universe in which we live. And our sun responds one way or the other, depending on the electromagnetic forces within our solar system.
And even in the galaxy, I think, the central core of our galaxy.
That's right. The center of the Milky Way. And that's where we have the story of this alignment to the galactic center.
Yes.
In 2012, and what that will actually mean in practice. And that's what I hope Peter will tell us in Suffolk on the 17th of Friday, the 17th of April.
Very good. So it's interesting hearing about this, and people should keep an eye on it and be aware of it, as it were. It's a really interesting area, and we'll just have to, for those who are still around in 2012, we just have to see what happens as well, and see what the outcome will be, and if it will be dramatic or not. Time will reveal that. But Edmund, maybe we can spend some time here talking a little bit about Göbekli Tepe, this site in Turkey that many people have claimed to be the Garden of Eden. There are some researchers out there who are talking about this. Some say it's the oldest temple site in the world and all this stuff. When you look at the pictures from the site, when you read about it, what is your take on what this site is, basically?
Well, Göbekli Tepe is right at on the end of an elongated mountain. It's very high up. It's got fantastic views over all the surrounding valleys. It has the benefit of this extraordinary limestone, which seems to be the material used to quarry these stones. They describe it as 20 underground rooms, and it's about 1,000 feet above the valley. Göbekli Tepe means in Turkish a hill with a belly. And it's really the most prominent hilltop in the area. It's just the kind of place that you would want to go if you wanted security, the best possible views, ideal building stone, and you wanted to take the advice of the gods. And this was the advice given to all the tribes around the world, is that we're going to have problems, folks. Dig a large pit, cover it with logs and earth, and hide. And this is the traditional history. So we had clever people, clever gods or God around at that time who knew there was going to be a major catastrophe or problem. And within the tribal histories, that is related through. And, of course, the tribal histories say but a few people survived and life started all over again. And this was worldwide. So Göbekli Tepe could well be a situation where it was built quite deliberately as a safe place to go to, up on a hill, very well drained, with marvelous views. All these things are very important, with the right kind of building materials to do the key job of. And clearly the stones are roof supports. I think everybody now accepts that they are roof supports. people didn't worship in front of them. And I've said earlier, worship comes from the word workshop, and temples that come from Taimon or Taimen, which were sacred areas. And our modern ideas of religion and paganism and cults is such utter nonsense. I just get very frustrated when people bring into the subject, as this book called The Genesis Secret by somebody whose name is given as Tom Knox, but I think it could be one or two or three other people. And this was the article on your website, which was reproduced from the Daily Mail.
Yes.
And I actually was given this book by one of my key networkers, and I've actually gone through it. And I'm extremely disappointed. I just feel that the whole thing is a complete scam in order to be able to promote and sell a book called The Genesis Secret.
Mm.
Other people can draw their own conclusions, but it doesn't bear any relationship to the history that I've done my work on over the last 15, 20 years.
How about how about if we look at the carvings, like on the side of the of the rocks, do you think that that's just, you know, decorative, or do you think that that might maybe have been done even afterwards? This this complex could have been used, and as you say, as some kind of shelter, basically at that point. But afterwards, it must have almost gotten a religious meaning, I guess. If this was a location where people survived a cataclysm, it might have been revered and venerated after that point. You know what I mean?
I think that if we work on the basis of hunter-gatherers in this area, and we also have to look at climate and also look at the relationship to what we call the Younger Dryas. The Younger Dryas was an incredibly cold period of time from 10,800 to 9,500 BC. And if we look at Abu Huraira and many of the nearby sites, we find that they were living off 60, 70% gazelles, for example, hunter-gatherers, one particular gazelle migration. And when agriculture did arrive, or the seed merchant arrived with the bag, then we find that they literally converted to farming, with predominantly farming, within a period of 100 years. But the objects carved are vultures, cranes, ducks, geese. There are lions, spiders, snakes, and scorpions. These are all the kind of things that practical people interested in wildlife and wildlife management, they would all be looking at all these things. And it's a classic indication, in my opinion, and the superior technology of finishing that stonework, carving that stonework, some of the pillars, roof supports being up to 10 tons in weight. Tallest, I think, is 12 feet, a 65-foot ring of stone out of that limestone. They were all circular houses, without any doubt in my mind, for quite a large population of people who chose that site to work from or base. There are stone hammers and blades. There is what I call Karsag technology, extraordinary skill in smoothing that stone and carving that stone. There are over 100,000 bone fragments, which were clearly butchered and cooked on site. And there was wild game, boar, sheep, and red deer. And my view is that that kind of sophistication certainly would have existed before the great catastrophe. We see it in the cave paintings and drawings and a whole number of objects that we have found. But it's not far from Karsag. And it's my view that there must be, with the technology and the timing here, we've got a very good chance of the people who had gone up to the top of that mountain were people who were aware of Karsag and what was happening at Karsag. And we may well have a party of what I call angels and watchers as the culture bearers, doing their work in surveying, mapping out, looking at the whole area, following the great catastrophe and spreading their influence around in the area. That seems to make good sense to me. The point about that area of Anatolia is that from the pollen cores we have, and from the bioarchaeological information, it wasn't that area wasn't a glacial refuge. The glacial refuge for the key plants, the oak, the pistachio, the wire grasses, the wheats, etc., was in the area around Damascus, quite a small area in Lebanon, in that area of the running down from Damascus to Jericho. And that is a far better candidate for the start of farming, and many of the world's experts have always considered that farming must have started as a single site somewhere in that area, which just takes us back to Karsak. Mm. And so we're looking at an outpost. It might have been an observatory. Several people have suggested that the 12 stones and the structure may well have been an important observatory. And we have in the books of Enoch the angels surveying the sun, moon, and stars, going off and measuring, being involved in studying the people, studying the animals, studying the fauna and flora. And it just looks very much like a link of bright, clever people who were the culture bearers from our stories of the Karsag epics, etc.
Do you think that this Indo-European race of people, that they had a global society going, basically, that they have communications and outposts, as you say, almost across the globe, and that there were communication going on between continents at that time as well?
Well, I just urge people to read the books by Lieutenant Colonel L.A. Waddell. Read all his books, please. Also read the books on the ancient American civilizations by Roof and Hyatt Verrill, V-E-R-R-E-L-L. They're it's very, very important. They provide a source for many later books that were written to make it clear in my mind that there was one world, and that the senior Aryan Sumerians, Sargon I, for example, and his son Menes, and the family over several generations, were traveling the world, visiting their colonies all around the world. And we find Sumerian artifacts in the Americas, the links with the Indian tribes, and we find the same at Tiwanaku. In India, we find that Manu is a name used in India and the Himalayas. It's also used not far from Tiwanaku near Lake Titicaca. We've got the Fuenta Bowl. It's just an endless list of similarities. And I've got a lovely little drawing in front of me, in fact, of six different types of hat, which are all the same type of hat. And I'm going to put, where did you get that hat? And each one of the people wearing those hats is so far, you know, they're just scattered around the world, from the old world, new world. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And to suggest that people have the same hat all around the world would suggest they came from the same source.
That's right.
And my learning from history part three, I deal with this question of ships and shipping and knowledge we have of the Sumerians having very efficient ocean-going craft. I think there were 65 different terms for different types of ship within the Sumerian records. Mm-hmm. And remember, 93 of our English words we speak today are Sumerian words. Look at Waddell and see how he reaches that conclusion.
Mm-hmm,
and so we do have an extraordinary link between the Vedas and the Sumerian literature, and of course the Eddas, which we talk about as well. Eddas were the epic poems, in the same way that the Vedic material were the epic poems. And they're talking about one and the same thing. They're talking about the great Sumerian civilization which colonized the world. And the stories of them colonizing Britain is clear around about 4,200, 3,500. We have the story of the Baxing tribes traveling down the Silk Road towards a group going into India, into Tibet, and key people, Hung Ti and Shen Rung, who is Sargon, going to China around about 2,700 BC.
You think they brought a lot of culture with them to China as well? We know that China has also a long history of a very ancient culture in that sense, but do you think that they were, how should we put it, aided along as well by the help of the Sumerian kings and
yeah.
people?
Well, I do. I think that the point about China is we have Fuxi and evidence of Karsag millet and wheat and barley in China very, very early. We're talking about Fuxi being there 7,500 BC, maybe earlier. If you look at the language and writing, if you compare the Sumerian and Chinese lexicon, as Charles Wall did, in about 1890, and Terrien Le Couperi, who wrote a book called The Western Origins of Chinese Civilization, you find that the Sumerian pictorial texts and the Chinese pictorial texts are almost the same thing. The common words, common language, it's absolutely staggering. And it's such good news, I think, to realize that we are all so closely related, emanating from that original, incredible Sumerian civilization, which goes much, much earlier than people claim. It goes certainly goes back, the dates for Europe now go back to 4,500 BC.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're seeing great towns and cities at 4,500 BC. And then we can push back to Sabi Abiad. We can eventually get back to Kutul Hayek. And you've got a time span between the birth of Christ, if you like, and the start of restart of civilization at 9,500 BC. There's a lot of big gaps to fill in, and we're now finding the scientific evidence and the archaeological evidence to fill in those gaps. And Göbekli Tepe is a wonderful example of seeing great skills, great specialization, extraordinarily interesting and important site, which, in my opinion, gives terrific weight to all the arguments that Karsag was active at the same time, close to Mount Hermon.
Very interesting. And maybe we should just spend the last couple of minutes here then that we have left, Edmund, on talking about, you mentioned briefly a little bit in the first segment about, neurotherapy, the science of basically the brain and how this could help us and aid us, and this is something that you've been looking into recently as well, then, and just think that this, do you think that this could be the root of many illnesses, or at least as the cure for many illnesses, that we can, with the aid of, you can explain how this is being done, of course, and what you mean by neurotherapy. Many people think of it in terms of hemisync, for instance, where you actually synchronize the different the brain halves, with the aid of frequency or sound. But this is what you're talking about is something different. This is with electricity. Is that right?
Yes, it's recognizing that we our universe. We have an electrical magnetic universe. And surprise, surprise! We have electrical magnetic people living in it.
Yes.
And so we find that we have a very extraordinary mechanisms in our brain which operate effectively or may malfunction through changes in electrical impulses, waves, etc. Now, Dan Winter is dealing with this subject, and he's introducing the neurotherapy breakthrough on human health at the Stars and Stones Forum. And his website is goldenmean.info. And there's a lot of very important material there, including the work of Marty Wirtz. And this is American-based and extraordinary understanding now that if we balance the various frequencies or brain waves on the three parts of our brain, we can get our bodies and minds to work much better and provide conditions where the body will heal itself. I don't want to get too deep into the technical issues, but I have one very practical example from my own personal experience. Not that I've been a drug addict, but I've worked very closely with Professor Carl Schmidt, who in 1980 had proven that you can remove addiction, a craving for whatever drug you're taking by passing a low voltage current from the acupuncture points between, is behind the ear. And this is called NET, N-E-T, look up NET on the website. and you'll see the equipment and the progress and the research that's now being undertaken in Scotland and in York University and Bristol University. And healing addiction without drugs has been a reality since 1980. It was done in a National Health Service hospital at Yeovil by Professor Carl Schmidt. And his longtime assistant came up to me at a political meeting and said, I work for Professor Carl Schmidt. I analyzed all his records and looked at all his patients and their progress. These patients have all become our friends. And he had a 90% success rate.
Right.
It's absolutely, this is critical because there are 236 methadone deaths each year in England alone. The cost of methadone each year is at least 111 million. And so people are being prescribed methadone and dying from it in those numbers. The cost of drug and alcohol addiction to society in England is of the order of £39 billion. And this could have been checked and stopped a long while ago. It is another extraordinary national scandal because of political bias against the idea of using what in fact was an acupuncture method used in Hong Kong, which a marvelous lady called Meg Patterson discovered from Dr. Wang. Dr. Wang had an opium addict who he was treating acupuncture, and he decided one day, well, let's just put a low-voltage current between the acupuncture needles either side behind the ear. And about 2 or 3 weeks later, this gentleman came back and said, I don't know what you did to me, but I've lost my craving for opium.
Because we know that.
And this was another extraordinary discovery, which has taken 30 or 40 years to get into the mainstream. It's just getting into the mainstream now. Mm-hmm. But it opens up this whole world of neurotherapy and understanding that so many people in prison, so many people who don't fit in or have difficulties or frustrations or anger, they simply have got problems with balancing the brain waves, the waves in the brain, the balance between the three key parts of the brain. And it's being able to resolve that problem, understand that problem, have neurofeedback so that we can look and see what specific problems different people have and understanding the best treatments for them, is that we can provide the best form of preventative medicine and bring out the best in people. And this is so important within a society which is growing more aggressive, more totalitarian, more confrontational, and telling us all exactly what we've got to do. We have to break that particular mold as soon as we can. Otherwise, we will have politicians building labor camps because they will be too broke to pay anybody their wages. This happened in Russia. It happened with Hitler's Germany. And it's going the same way now with another great, not a capitalist failure, a socialist failure to understand a money supply has to be effectively controlled for any society to run efficiently and smoothly.
Because when you mentioned with the drugs as well, we know that basically what drugs do to your brain is that they rewire your neural pathways, you know, in order to stimulate basic communication between pathways in your brain that actually releases endorphins and basically makes you feel good, right? So you become addicted to the flow of the electricity that exists within the brain anyway, in a sense, which might sound kind of weird, but the chemicals just release certain chemicals inside us, which gives us energetic flows in the brain. So what you're describing there is it possible that could be, how should we put it, that it might be rewiring in some way the natural neural pathways of the brain if that is stimulated by energy, or do you know more specifically how exactly it works?
Well, the simplest way I describe it, and I may not be totally right, is that we have receptors, and those receptors need to be lined up properly.
Yes.
If we overload or take any substance in excess, then we fuzz up those receptors and connections. And we can soon realign them by passing the correct low-voltage current through the head. but we give ourselves all sorts of problems. And the main problem is that, I mean, in the 1970s, it was discovered that the human body manufactures its own indigenous opioids, which are endomorphins, as you say.
Yes.
And these function as neurotransmitters and give us the feel-good factor. So we need this feel-good factor, and we need to manufacture ourselves within us these endomorphins. These are also stimulated by physical activity. So physical exercise is another key element. So if you're a couch potato, you're heading in the wrong direction anyway, especially if they don't smoke hash.
Right.
Unfortunately, these substances of addiction, which include nicotine and alcohol,
yes,
suppress the production and release of these opioids or endomorphins. So you end up by suppressing your own body's natural mechanisms. Now, consequently, if we try and reduce one drug dependency by using another or the same drug, for example, if we replace methadone with heroin, which prevents the production and release of our own opioids, our addiction most likely remains, and it takes a long time to overcome. So you can't use another substitute. And, of course, my own experience is that every kind of prescription drug given to young people who have drug problems, they all have their side effects and difficulties, and some of them are worse than the original problem.
And that's what they've been experimenting with, primarily with these SSRIs. What's it called? It's reuptake inhibitor. What is the initials there? SSR. Anyway, it's another set of these drugs that has been targeted towards the receptors in your brain to release, you know, endorphins in a particular way and all this. And what I've been able to see from that is that it's absolutely horrendous, and the kids are totally numb that go on these drugs, and the adults too, of course, but their emotional life is totally disconnected, and they have nothing, they don't experience any emotion anymore. Some people claim that they've been helped, yada yada, and that's great for them, that's wonderful, but from the majority, what I've been hearing about is that people become like zombies on these drugs, and it's just a horrendous picture that is unveiling here, and much in the same way, which in a way the society is going, that we are being controlled by,
I'm sure you're absolutely right, because we're brain damaged. Society is damaging our brains in almost every area.
Yeah.
You either try and fight it, but it's hellish difficult to fight it. And it's very difficult to find like-minded people who can move in the right direction. And there's nothing worse than removing our free will, because that's what's happening. Our free will has been taken away from us.
Mm.
And one thing the ancients understood and the Druids understood was that free will was the most important thing that each of us has. And that is the one thing that makes us perform better and do things better. And nature itself has to have free will to function and perform. If you regiment people and you restrict them and you put them in a totalitarian environment, even if that means giving them dodgy drugs to try and cure one particular problem or another, you're just damaging people further. And it's the way in which the state pumps money into these kind of programs, give them more pills, give them more drugs, and this must be about the most crazy thing that's happening on the planet today. Not understanding that 30 years ago, we could actually heal addiction without drugs and get people into rehabilitation and useful work if we actually cared about those people in the first place.
Yeah, well, exactly.
And then we have a £39 billion bill to society in Britain. And 90% of the inmates in Exeter Jail in Britain are there for drug-related offences. Something like 50% are still on drugs, although they're in a secure prison environment.
Yeah.
How much madder are we going to be when we're allowing people to go to prison and damage their brains even further than they were damaged before they got there in the first place?
Well, it all serves the, you know, black market economy, if you will, and the relationship between politicians and the mafia, the drug lords in many countries. And I personally think that the two are interlinked on many levels. And again, it has been shown that even the CIA is, you know, having their own planes driving drugs back and forth into, you know, between Mexico and the US, you know. So there's something else going on here. And I feel at this point, at least, that this is If the government didn't want it, it would not exist. But if they truly would like to crack down on this problem and solve it, I think that they actually could. But we're in a time right now where tragedy, where threats to society is actually serving the cause, if you will, for the global agenda more for them than if it would have been taken away, because they need the problems in order to propel more control, to instigate more control on us. You know, they need something to remind us that, hey, look at this, look at all the problems that exist out there in the world. You need us, just as the politician says in that movie V for Vendetta. He says that they need to know why they need us. You know, in whatever you do, do not let go of that. You know, they need us as the big daddy, the secure, you know, that can secure their environment and to keep them safe, and with this promise that as long as we are your rulers, we're going to keep you safe and everything's going to be good. So it's a very, very complex issue, if you will, in that sense, and we're in a horrible situation at the moment, obviously, but ultimately, if we should boil it down, I guess I feel much in the same way that you talked before, Edmund, about personal freedom, that this is also about personal choice and responsibility, meaning that if we were interested in who we are and where we come from, of course, and also where we're going, we could find out things ourselves. We can go on the web, we can go into a library, we can start reading books, we can get interested in who we are and how things work, and take responsibility for our own lives instead of just giving it up all the time, as we seem to be doing right now, to someone else who's supposed to handle the problem, if you know what I mean. To me, it's very simple in that way, but it's very difficult because you can't convince anyone else to become interested in who they are, really. It has to be there to begin with, the inherent drive or interest in this type of things. That's what I see at this point, at least. I don't know about you, Edmund.
Well, I think the people can win. I think things are so bad in politics and religion that a few breaths of fresh air can bring about enormous change. Never underestimate the power of the people. We've seen this in history. But the people have to have the facts straight. It's no good having the kind of riots we had in London on the G20, no, with about 20 different organizations all disagreeing with each other before they got together to demonstrate.
Yeah.
But what I would say is there is a marvelous charity called the LifeWorks Foundation. And the LifeWorks Foundation, I'm now involved with, Dan Winter's involved with them, and they are doing fantastic work on this neurotherapy concept, and also this wonderful idea of looking for the master craftsman, looking for the movers and shakers, the innovators who are otherwise being ignored and neglected. We need to look for the genuine, the best knowledge we can find on each of the subjects which affect the way our planet operates. And this is, would you believe, a new approach. And I think there's tremendous potential. So don't forget the LifeWorks Foundation and what they're doing and what we can do if we all work together in harmony and look for the kind of social organization where everybody wins.
Sounds good, Edmund. Thank you very much for your time here today. It's been a very eclectic and a varied discussion, which is great, by the way. It's always good to tie things in with old, new, modern, and ancient, interesting areas, and I love it. One, why don't you give some of your websites again to us before we round things up, and also mention a few of the book titles that you recommend? I guess primarily from Christian O'Brien's and Barbara Joy O'Brien's publications, like The Shining Ones and a few other ones. Go ahead and mention those to people who are interested.
Yes, I keep even more saying to people that the key book, the definitive source book, is called The Genius of the Few by Christian and Barbara Joy O'Brien, which can be obtained by going to the goldenageproject.org.uk website. This, until I arranged for it to be republished, was one of an incredibly popular book in the States. It's probably the most photocopied book going in the States up until the time that I republished The Genius of the Few. And it goes from strength to strength because it really has they stood the test of time as this common sense approach. It was much too sensible for the fringe who wanted Sitchin and the other extreme alien type views. But it was far too scholarly for the establishment. And those are the words of Colin Wilson, who was an excellent historian. But please read The Genius of the Few. There's a tremendous amount of information packed in there, including an alternative translation of the Genesis text, which changes a few words about the bright ones or shining ones in the plant in Highlands, and not God in heaven. And as soon as we get back to the idea that we always had a single monotheistic system centered on An, who was the leader of this group of people, along with Enlil, Ninkarsag, Enki. This is where these names come from. And they've been abused and misused, and we've been told that we had a nuclear war. But that nuclear war was, if you look at the dates given for it, it was evidence of the same period of time when we had the second great global catastrophe caused by cometary debris, round about 2345. So that's the key book, that's the key website. And you'll find a lot more material on the Golden Age Project website. There are about 1.5 million hits every month now, and new visitors approaching 17,000 a month. But I just hope you look at it and give that book a chance, because it's a starting point for understanding that nearly all religion goes right back to one benevolent source. We don't need to fight one another. We don't need to have differences about the past if we realize that everything goes back to, if you like, the Abrahamic faith. In terms of Muhammad and Jesus, neither wanted a new religion. They wanted to go back to the Golden Age. They wanted to go back to the Abrahamic faith, which was a superb social organization of the early city-states. That lesson can do more good for the planet than anything else. So come aboard, read the book, and spread the word.
Very good. Again, the website is goldenageproject.org.uk. Thank you very much, Edmund, for your time. And, of course, have a great time at the Stars and Stones Forum here in April.
Thank you very much, Dean Henry. That was great.
Thank you.
Thank you.